This is Janet Anderson right here, and the session is The Process of Creating. You have all been given a piece of paper. And what I would like you to do is to hold that piece of paper in front of you, full width open, not folded, and look at it. And then I'm going to ask that you not do anything right now, but to think about yourself in relationship to that blank piece of paper and what you personally could do to, with, or on that piece of paper that would somehow be a statement of yourself or an extension of yourself or a growth part of yourself, somehow where you would be part of the process with that paper. And I want to give you a couple seconds to think about that. Okay, now, this is a sort of a trick. What I want to hear now is a statement of some of the feelings you were feeling when I handed the paper out to you, and then I asked you to relate to that blank piece of paper, feelings, thoughts, anything like that, you know, that just list them.
It
out loud.
Entered my mind when I got the paper that this is a volunteer class.
Okay. And
you need to volunteer somewhere else.
Right. Like you might want to leave, right?
Threat.
Go ahead.
Limits.
Just say them out loud. You don't need to raise your hand.
I immediately thought you wanted us to draw something. Mm-hmm.
And what did that make you feel?
Inadequate.
Draw something equals inadequate. Inadequate. Okay.
Frustrated.
Maybe I'm weird, but I felt joy.
All right.
I can't wait to fill this with words.
Okay.
There's somebody who didn't bring paper along.
Anything else? Anybody else have anything else?
Yeah, nervous.
Nervous.
Challenge.
Fun.
Okay.
Service.
Creative.
Pardon?
Creative.
Okay. I did this because I wanted you to get into sort of a mental place of what it means to face a blank canvas, a blank piece of paper, a blank page. And I would like to say that I feel that you cannot participate in creation of any kind without first confronting or knowing yourself. And any artist or musician or writer, anyone who's involved in any kind of creative act, I believe has to wrestle with all these problems every time it's a new thing. If we don't feel these things, including the joy, the fun, but the nervous, all these things welling up, then in fact, possibly, it could be a repetitive event for you that you have already crossed the bridge of creativity. Does that make sense to you? So that this is something that a person who is living a creative life is living with all the time. Because they're constantly, you know, aware that something could be done and yet at the same time frustrated, feeling inadequate. Will I be able to do it? Will I be able to communicate? And at the same time, it's often nonverbal. I mean, you're not sitting there thinking, especially for me as a visual person, I'm not sitting there thinking, aha, you know, I'm going to, like you said, words. You know, I'm thinking color maybe. And it's nonverbal. But these are all part of the process of creating and it's part of getting to know yourself in relationship to creativity. I want to read one quote here, just to boot. This is a woman artist who is out of Ann Truitt from Maryland, Day Book, The Journal of an Artist, which if anyone's interested, this would be a good book. We don't have it here, but possibly you could order it through your local bookstore. The Greek poets saw and felt and then wrote. They learned from suffering, and the way they learned was to make the effort to articulate their personal experience into forms that transcended it. They combined examined experience with the discipline of art to bring forth a statement forever useful to their fellow human beings, a way that beckoned people toward aspiration. And one of the things that is difficult for people in today's world, because it is such a verbal world, is the visual artist is often very threatening, and we often reject that work. But I think what it is often it's a language. It's a visual language that we are very young with, or very, I don't want to use the word immature, but in some ways we are. We speak a lot, we read a lot, and we often don't just experience what we see. So there's a special thing going on here with the visual artist, but I'm trying to broaden it into all people and all creative action. And then I had one other thing here I wanted to read. Let's see. Oh, I know what it was. This is a quote from Isaac Bishop, a singer. And it's quite long, but I wanted to say it because I think he's making a connection here that I want to put before your minds before we begin, so you can have it ruminating in the back while we're talking about other things. As it entertains, art keeps on searching for the eternal truths in its own fashion. It still tries to penetrate the essence of being, to ponder the riddle of time and change, to find some answer to suffering, to reveal love in the very abyss of cruelty and injustice. The true artist has never made peace with death and oblivion. He knows that we are a fragment of God's unending book, a moment in eternity. Our hopes are closely connected with all the stars, all the galaxies of the cosmos. If the universe is an accident, so are we. If the universe makes sense, so do we. This is the message both of religion and of art. That puts sort of a grandiose envelope around what we're going to be talking here. But because of who I am and because of my background, I think of the process of creating in relationship to my belief as a creator God, and me being in, and all of us being in the image of God. So that is sort of an envelope. Now, I'd like to step outside of that and spend the next 15 or 20 minutes or so taking you on sort of a visual two-year journey with me. I'm a painter, and a few years back, I finished my PhD, and one part of it was getting enough work together in a new direction for me for a one-woman show. And one of the things that every artist that I know, including myself, says is a reality is that you actually receive inspiration from the work as you're working. Often you have some inspiration to get an idea, but then as you're working and process, in that process of working, you get more and more inspiration. Okay? That is something that we all say. So this is kind of interesting for me because there's about 26 slides we have, and they are slides of my work over a two-year period. And as I was putting this together, I thought this is really interesting because the relationship from the beginning and where I started and to where I ended, it goes this really long circuitous route, but in some senses they relate after 2 years. And yet each piece was related to the piece before it. Is this making any sense to you? Okay. And so I have some slides. And, do you want to turn that on there? Okay, now one of the things that did happen, I went to seminary, and part of my project was working a little bit with the concept of spirit and biblical concepts of spirit. And so this is 5 years or so after seminary, and I still was doing some of these things. This is an abstract painting about 4 by 5 feet. It started out with a very strong, vertical, horizontal. And see, I'm talking to you now afterwards. When I was working on this, I didn't have a lot of these visual knowledges. I just did the painting, and then afterwards, now I've come back and I have a lot of interpretations. Whether in fact they are the interpretations or not, it's just me coming back as critic. But the struggle I had was trying to loosen up. I'd been working a lot in flat planes of color. And so it started somewhere in here where I began to just start to break up the flatness by trying to have it sort of mottled wads of cotton or pieces of color. And it slowly evolved into the total painted surface almost being a circular form, but sort of rough and very undefined in a lot of ways. There was a lot of color on top of color. There wasn't a lot of organization. It was very turbulent. Still keeping, you know, a little bit of this placid blue or areas of color. But notice it's a circular form within a rectangular space. All right, that was called Spirit Study 1. Okay, then I was responding then to the shape of the canvas. That was a given to me. It was a rectangular shape saying, okay, if I'm going to break apart all the lines completely, the only given to me is the shape of the canvas. So this was Spirit Study 2. Now do you see how the shapes related to the one before? Okay. But it basically went right off the canvas. It didn't stay in one central place, although there is some circular motion there. Then I said, no, I wanted to have a feeling of movement that was within. This is Spirit Study 3. And I was working a lot with the circular form. I had done another one a couple years before, so it was going back to that. But I got into, as a friend, what did she call these? It's like mangoes. But this one, I wanted to get some of the roughness of the spirit or the idea of movement and unfinished and continuing on. And so there was this movement back in and amongst each other, and it was very busy. But somehow it still didn't feel right. In fact, I don't even know if I still have this painting anymore. But then saying, okay, if I take that concept of the circular movement and not trying to necessarily destroy my work, why not refine the idea of the circular movement? And so I started in this painting to refine the idea of a spirit idea as a circular movement, as power bursting out. And so what I did is I started, as I was working with this concept, I started to make it more and more rigid. I took away some of the lines, and yet at the same time, I accented some. And so if you look at this in relationship to this, whoops, that's the next one, sorry. No, what's happening? I pushed it backwards. Reverse. That's not doing it right. Do you want to do it, David? This is not working. It says I pushed reverse. I want to go back.
You have to click it to reverse. Isn't
there? To click it? No, see, that's going the wrong way. Just on the bottom, no. On the back, and it says forward, reverse. Just push the reverse button.
Okay.
Will that work? Yeah, go back. No, we're going forward. There, okay, right. Okay, all right. Now go back one.
There you go. Yay.
No, that's not right.
Next one.
One more.
Go back.
It's not, because the machine isn't going back.
Okay, well, then just go back to the same one we're at. Why is this not working?
The reverse apparently doesn't work.
Okay, all right. Well, I wanted to juxtapose it in your eye, but then here we got to the idea of instead of having the circular form within the canvas, I was trying to take it and have it feel that this sort of cosmic idea was moving out. And I softened the colors and was working a lot with pastels, and I got very much into just a very gentle transition from color to color. Now, if you remember, that other one was very exciting with reds and blues, and then as I worked on it, I pasteled it. I mean, and as this one you can see, there's still very dark colors, and yet at the same time, the pastels are starting to take over. Now, one of the things that happened at this time is I got very, very frustrated because I was getting bored, and I was saying, this is doesn't have any life to me. It's pretty, and it's interesting, but I'm not growing with it. And so I have a friend who's an artist, and she was talking about, well, you know, maybe it's the canvas. And we talked about the idea that every single one of these is on its very rigid form. And the rigid form is the stretched canvas. It's rectangular, it's square, and so on. And I'm trying to work with these ideas of movement and looseness. So I don't have any slides right here, but I just want to say I took a piece of canvas, laid it on the floor, and just started to pour the paint on. There are quite a few artists who paint that way. Helen Frankenthaler is one of them, with beautiful areas of color. But it was exciting for me because I said, I don't need that rule. I don't have to stretch the canvas. I can break that rule and do something else. So it was an exciting breakthrough for me. Well, as I was doing that, I got to thinking about why not hang these unstretched pieces of cloth using varieties of cloth on the wall or on a wall while I painted. And so I took the pastel idea and I tacked a piece of cloth about 2 inches from the wall and I poured paint, still poured paint, still using the pastels. I can't get that one too clear. But I took a little measuring cup and I poured paint. None of these lines I painted. The paint painted it. The cloth was black and I just poured and it ran. Okay, can you see that? Maybe the next one is clearer. Okay, yeah, that's a little clearer. So what I did with this one is I allowed it to not have the rigid edges, but I had all of a sudden reverted back to a very linear thing, except I kept the pastels. And this was something, this was progress from one to the other, and at the time I was just doing what seemed to be the next step. And I wasn't necessarily saying this is right or wrong or anything, I was just progressing from one to the other. And so in some ways, I suppose it was almost like a backlash, because here I'd been trying to loosen things up and pour things messily all over the floor. I put it on the wall and all of a sudden it got very neat and tidy, but it still had the pastels. And one of the things that I got involved with at this time was black. And I have a couple things written here. One, this is the sharp, no, I don't need that. Black, excitement of openness, enclosed, limitless holes, totality of all, absence, moving as vapor, solid shadow, night falls, moonless, engulfing, swallowed, opening out barriers, becoming possibilities. That was in response to the process of pouring paint over black. And then I have another two short ones about these paintings. Lines parallel, move in circles, vibrating themselves into new realities, seen instantly, marking forever into now. Shimmering, floating vertically, at attention, yet unattached, we live each day. Poured pastels, formed, forming, spaces out of what we meet, dripping, intermingling, but remaining our own amongst another's. So I got, as a visual person, I got really excited about the depth of this. I'd been told as a young painter, never put black on your canvas because it makes a hole. Use burnt umber or something. But so I was breaking another rule here. But I loved this because it was like the paint was actually hanging in a void. And yet at the same time, the black held it together. And then I got into the idea of each of these is very individual, separate. In the painting itself, you can see that some are very hard-edged, some are very soft, and they flow into each other. And as I looked at it, I got the image, you know, of different people and different lives all going together and yet making a whole, and, you know, all that sort of philosophizing about what I actually was doing. Anyway, while I was doing this series, I lived in a rented apartment, all right? This is on the wall I'm wearing. So I had towels all over the floor and pieces of cloth to catch the paint, because as you're pouring, if you want it to run off the bottom, you're going to have excess. And so I started had these mounds of old towels with paint all over them, and I got involved with what happened to the paint as it flowed out onto the floor. And I took some cloth, just dropped it on the floor, sort of made a design. This one is called Mask. And I poured paint on the cloth as it was. Now remember we were talking before about the canvas being stretched. It had to be tight. I took it off, but I still painted with it flat. Then I said, why not really soften it if I'm going to work with pastels and more intimate colors that way? Why not use flannel and have it mountainous? And so this is where it came from, the towels. And I never would have guessed that was coming out when I was pouring on the flat. On the lines, the vertical lines, but this was the next step.
Yeah, that looks like something from Judy Chicago.
The shine, you mean, or the
shape?
The shape. Yeah. Okay. Now this one, as a tidbit of information, David's grandfather's scarf is partly in here, so I've called this grandfather's scarf. But I've also called it new land, all sorts of things. But I got very involved then with the whole idea of letting the paint interact with itself in the different colors, and I would only choose the place to pour it, and then I'd stand and watch it. And then there'd be times where I'd say, no, don't go any further. And I'd talk to the paint as it rolled out past. And so it became, I learned a new technical skill, how to handle latex house paint, intermixing with itself. But so you can see that progress. And see, now think of this in relationship back to the first circular ones. All right. The same time I was thinking of the black, I was thinking of pouring paint, and I thought, I don't need the black. Well, if I really think of the black as openness, why do I have to put it on cloth? So I put up some plastic on the wall, poured paint on the plastic, waited a certain amount of time, pulled the paint off the plastic, and then hung it on an aluminum rod. So these are actually strips of paint on nothing. So if I'm going to get rid of the canvas, if I'm going to get rid of this structure, then why? And what I'm interested in is the paint. Why not just do the paint? And this is an interesting experiment because I learned that Sherwin-Williams makes the best paint for my purposes. Because sometimes I'd use some cheap, and they would just stretch and just break and go on the ground. This one stretched to a certain point and just stopped, and it was just exactly what I wanted. It was very pliable, and yet at the same, and so it would move in the breeze at the same time. Can you focus? Oh, David, are you there?
Yeah, can I focus that any better?
That's good.
Oops. So you can see through it, and yet at the same time, the paint is a solid reality.
Wasn't that really laborious to get the paint off the plastic and onto a...
Well, if I pulled it off within, I did it at night and did the next morning, it would pull right off. Certain kinds of plastic get stuck. Garbage bags, I think. The cheap garbage bags work the best. And I could pull it off right then, and it would stick to each other. It would stick right on here. But if I waited 24 hours, it wouldn't do it. It was just sort of a thing I had to learn about, the technology of paint. Okay. Okay. Now, here's another one. This is actually, you can't see it here, but it's actually two, it's an X like this, so that it has the same thing. But I made them 6 feet by 6 feet square. And back to my square, but I'm taking the reality of the square there. Seriously. Oh. All right. Then I said, well, why do I have to do in a straight line? Why not a square? Why a square? Why not a circle? So I have, this is three concentric circles. One, there's a small one in the middle. You can't really see it. And so this doesn't catch it quite as much, but when the light hit it right, it looked like a solid column, and yet it would move. So it was circular, and yet it was solid, and it had that feeling of all these strips of many colors floating in this space. And one of the things that I said a couple weeks ago when I was talking about this, although I didn't have the slide, at the opening of the art show, a little girl, 4 years old, went up to it and was just standing and looking at it. And then she opened her arms, and she walked right into it and right through it. And I thought that was great, because to me, she was responding to what had come through me into this piece of artwork. And her mother, of course, had a cow. She said, you're going to break it. But if it had been cold, it probably would have shattered, but it was warm, so it was okay. In fact, this is no more because it did went below freezing, and then we tried to carry it, and the paint just shattered. But anyway, there's the concentric circles, there's the pastel, there's the vertical. It was a replaying of some of the old things that have been going on, but out of my personal statement.
Dan, could I ask you a question about it? Did you stretch the plastic or put the plastic out and paint it straight and then put it in the circle, or did you stretch
it? That didn't have any plastic on it. That was just the paint.
But when you painted it originally, you had to have plastic, right?
Yeah, and I did it on the wall. I took a measuring cup, and I'd hold it right there and pour.
So the plastic was flat.
Yeah.
And then you hung it in the circle. After
right. I took the paint off the flat, and I hung it in the circle. Right. Okay, now this one is a close-up of a small one I did called Caught in the Process. It had a cross form, and then these zigzags came off of the arms of the cross. And I sold this one to a person, and about a year later she wrote me and said, guess what happened? The garage door opened, and the wind came in and blew it down and smashed the smithereens. But I do have another slide close-up somewhere, so I have a record of it. But this I wanted to show because this is actually the aluminum rods. I was trying to break the straight lines and have a little more of the globiness of the paint. I wanted to have the feeling of the wet, moist, moving stuff, and at the same time have a little variety because I was being so regular and organized, and I wanted to have different colors mixing, and I was starting to mess more with the paint. Okay, a couple more here. Now this one is called Parthenogenesis, and David named it, so he helps me name it. But in one sense, that term is birthing out of itself. And in one, this was on a grid, a light grid that you buy in a hardware store, with cotton stuck on it. So the grid is still there, and yet at the same time, it's almost like this life is oozing out of the grid. And the grid can't hold it. So this is paint strips, cotton balls, sort of, what can I say? This is about 4 feet by 2.5 or something like that.
Is that the Sherwin-Williams latex too?
That's Sherwin-Williams too.
That's latex.
Yeah, this is semi-gloss latex house paint. Okay. Now, I have another poem here that sort of fits with this one. The cotton balls grow into huge environments, not sticky like cotton candy, nor suffocating like thick, stale air, but a kind of quiet amusement park with boundless, free, gentle rides taken at leisure as one walks on a warm spring evening. Now, remember the lines? This now is a line. I says, why are my lines all vertical? I says, why not put them horizontal? But I'd been working with cotton, so I took a strip of wood, I think it was 8 feet strip of wood, put cotton all over to soften the line and dripped it. And this is hung, so the illusion is it's floating in space. So there are actually a couple strings you can see. But I just called it the long line. But it's sort of softening the line. But see, I started to play with cotton now and polyester batting and stuff. Okay, at this time I started to just have fun with paint. There's about 4 or 5 here that I played with. Whatever happened to be around. There's a lot of plastic flowers, little Avon perfume. This one is called Goddess of the Hunt. And it's got plastic, blue daisies. I mean, it's really gauche stuff I used. And yet at the same time, there was a real poignancy when it was done because the paint was actually imprisoning the head because it came off the top and came down, and she was inside this, the face of a woman was inside this pastel, shiny pastel prison. And then this one was, her name's Miranda from the Phil Oak song. Her name's Miranda, or Carmen Miranda. And there was just something I found in Salvation Army with some plastic stuff, and I wanted to see how the paint would move on it. I liked the curlicues and some plastic fruit. And I was playing with transforming garbage or things I found into a total unit that was saying something about who I was. But I wasn't thinking all that. If I get too esoteric when I'm doing this, it gets too didactic, so I try not to think too much. I just respond to the color or space or something. This one is hard to tell, but it was a jewelry box that I opened, and I stuck plastic flowers in it and then put cloth around it, and there's some more perfume and poured paint over it, so that it became a total unit. And in some ways, I suppose it's a statement on womanhood in our society. You know, you could do a lot of images from that on these few here. This is a chair. That's the back. This is the front. And one of the things that I hadn't thought of when I was working on it, I was just working on it as a unit, and David says, you know, the thing about this chair that I really like, which now I like too, but I hadn't thought of at the time, is there are tulips, plastic tulips, sticking up in the seat, which in some senses you have this feeling of tulips are spring and newness, and yet they're plastic, and they're also spiky. I mean, you cannot sit in this chair. This is an inviting chair, and yet there's absolutely no way that you can sit in it or use it or partake in it. It's just there. Anyway, other people might have other things to say about it. But.
Was that a fabric chair? Was there?
No, this actually was an aluminum lawn chair to begin with. And then I strung rope and I hung cloth. There's black chiffon in the back, and cloth around the bottom, and then poured paint on it. And I just would, sometimes I'd mix it partially and pour it on the arm, you know, and let it run. So
well,
like on the side.
Of it, the texture quality is created by the cloth or just by layer after layer of paint or what?
Yeah, partly that, and partly like I use some cloth and I use some cotton, like the parthenogenesis, I use some sticking of batting and stuff in to create and then there's a lot of flowers, plastic flowers in there, just to make it be so it had to move around things. Though when the paint was poured, it wasn't just flat. It had to go around and surround or cover different things. Now this one is called Baby on a Toaster. And I want to talk about it just a little and maybe get your responses. Well, I should have you talk first before I... Can you see what it is? This is a doll. And this is a toaster, and it's surrounded by flowers. And I just called it Baby on a Toaster. Do you have any feelings or images that, yeah?
My first impression of the baby was as a puto.
Oh, yeah?
What?
A puto, the little...
what are they called? Those little
yeah, cherubs. Putos. Yeah, cherubs.
Okay. And that's just the first thing I thought when I looked at it at night. And I was having a little trouble with it. It looked like an altar or something.
Okay.
But no, I thought of a toaster. But that was the first impression I had.
Why did you put it on a toaster?
Well, now, okay, now, going back to what I said at the beginning, that in a sense we are all conduits, or we're being in touch with ourselves, but at the same time we're maybe participating in something greater than ourselves. In a small way, when I was thinking, you say, why did you put it on a toaster? I don't know why I put it on a toaster. I had a toaster that didn't work. And I set it down on a table, and I go to junk stores and I collect things, and I just started to paint. And I put it on a toaster, and I wanted the plug to be right there. Okay. I can go, now that it's done and there's time, I could go back and say a lot of things about why I put it on a toaster. But when I was doing it and began, I don't know why I did. One of the things was, is my son was 2 years old. And I was starting to feel a lot of social pressures about having a boy grow up to be the right kind of boy. The idea of popping up the correct shade of brown, you know, the correct toast doneness. And so there was this idea of anger, I'm sure, about what society was forcing him into rather than just being a whole person. He had to be blue, he had to be a boy, and a lot of that. There's another part of it that I think people, one time I had it at a show, and people really got into the idea of theology and religion in the Christ child, and how we've made it sort of a electric belief in the sense that we have made our belief to be what we want it to be rather than what we can be part of. That, you know, can go many, many different ways with the piece. I have a friend who, He wanted it. He says, oh, I want it. And his wife said, I will not live with that in my house. So I mean, different people have very different reactions to this. Some are very angry about it. Some think it's funny. And some just like the colors. And I'm all three. So, you know, I don't really know. You might have other opinions. One of the things I really liked about it is it went back to the black, only it had the chrome. You can't see it here, but it had the chrome of the toaster shining through. So when you looked at it, you saw yourself. You know, little stuff like that. Playful stuff visually. Does anyone have anything else they'd like to say about that piece? Or it's a little haunting, but...
Yeah, it is to me. I can't decide for sure if I feel like almost like child abuse. You know, the cruelty, or baby on an altar, you know,
as a sacrifice. Yeah, yeah. Which to me all relate a little bit to growing up as a male, as my son growing up, and how in society he's being formed to be something he may not be, you know, by all the shoulds and the peer pressures. But you're taking it like an actual baby on an altar that's ready to be slaughtered, and so that relates to my feelings as a mother. Shouldn't be touching. But at the same time, it has a little, so it's humor and very serious at the same time. But I wasn't trying to make it anything. I was just creating a piece with what I had. Okay, then remember the circular forms on the flat surface. We had a globe, a moon globe, that we never used. This is a moon globe now. I wrapped it in cloth and rope, and then poured paint over it. So this is a hanging globe or sphere or whatever. But it was like, this was like 18 months, 2 years after those first ones. And a realization on my part, you know, I was going through a lot of steps and then realizing, look at how this does relate back to what I was working before. The inspiration came from each piece, and yet who I was as a person continued to exist along, as I worked along. And then this is another one, which I call, well, obviously the triangular form and things like that relates to theological images, but when I decided I'd done that ball, I says, what I'd like to do is six balls, and so I got beach balls and wrapped them and set them down and poured them.
It's like wrapping bowling balls.
Yeah, right. Another story, I don't know how much time is right now, but another story about this is I had this in a show in a junior college, and I came to pick it up, and this ball, or one of the corner balls, was flat. So this piece is no longer like this. And, you know, you have insurance and stuff, but they said they don't know what happened, you know, it was in the student union. And so I said, well, what can I say? But, so I said, for a long time, I felt the piece was ruined, because for me, this was the piece I had envisioned. And then, but I kept carrying it around. This is about, what is it, Dave? 5 feet on the side?
It's big to move.
Yeah, it's like 5 or 6 feet on a side. Well, however, 5 feet. And, you know, this is a difficult piece to move around and to have in your house, etc. So I said, why am I saving this, you know? Because it's ruined. I can't stand it. It makes me irritated. And then I took, for one show, I took this piece and set it on the floor. And I took the one that was just before, the moon, the globe, and I hung it by a long rope so that it hung right above, about 2 inches above the flattened one. And I called it replacement. And all of a sudden it had a whole new meaning and a whole new life because it was a whole new piece by relating the two. So that we still have it. Some of these things you know you live with for a while and you say it's time for it to be gone. Okay, remember the circles. Remember working with pastels. These are actually poured from the same cup I did with the lines, poured circles of paint where I put different colors of paint in, gave it one swirl so it wasn't mixed. And then I would just pour it onto a piece of plastic and try to be as equal as possible. And there's 144 there, square, 12 by 12. And after they dried, I got a clear piece of plastic and arranged them so that possibly all the circles of pastel, they're separate, but they all relate to each other so that they flow from green to peach and so on. But
I count 15.
Me too.
Oh, Okay, what is it? Oh, it's 15 by 15. I originally was going to have it 12 by 12, so that's what it is. 15 by 15.
That's on plastic now?
Yeah, that's on clear plastic. Here's a close-up. This is a... Okay, can you see how... They're all like individual worlds. They're all individual. They have a life of their own. But I tried to arrange them so that each one would somehow relate to the ones beside it.
They almost look like ceramic-type pieces.
Yeah. Now, this also has an interesting story. I guess I don't take good care of my stuff, but I sent it to a show by mail, and I had not, these were very dry, I mean it was a few months, but I had taken them out in order so they could be laid down again in order, but I didn't put plastic between them, and they got there and they were all one big long. It couldn't take them apart, so it was gone as a piece, but the idea is still there. So they couldn't put it up or show it. This is lying on the floor. So it's, in one sense, this piece, if you go back and say, well, it's the circles, it's the pastels, it's lying on the floor, and yet it's all related. In other words, this was a two-year time, and you can see how in the process of working with what I happened to be working with at the time, each one related to each other and related back to the beginning. So that's the last slide. Okay. Okay, one of the things that I want to push before I forget is this: the bookstore has this book, The Courage to Create. Maybe a lot of you have read this already, but it's a very good book about the process of creativity and also for each person to see themselves as creators and how that works out in their own lives. I think one of the things that is hardest to do when you're working in something like this is how to think a thought without hardening the thought in the process of thinking it. Like say, I'm going to do something, and then say, now I've all of a sudden achieved my little secure box and I'm going to continue doing this. The process is always finding something out and moving from one place, and that is always a stepping stone to the next place. And if you take that as a process of living your life, it means that you have to constantly live with the acceptance of change, and then in fact you have to anticipate change. I guess Rilke is the one who said you have to anticipate change as if you left it behind you. It's as if you are involved in something that's going on constantly, not only your life, but you're involved in something greater. Another thing that an artist does, I think, is it assumes that they have something to say. I mean, why would anyone create music unless they felt they had something to say? Same with a writer, same with a painter, and everyone, as we live our lives, we all have something individual to say. But it's that knowledge that you are special and that you do have something to say. That is constant also. Another image that is that goes along here, and I can't remember who said it, but it said, I think it was Anne Truitt, but I'm not sure, that it's like following one's nerve. You know, like in your body, your nerves, when they tense up, you can sort of follow them. It's like staying in close enough touch to the nerves of who you are so that you can continually go on to newness through that, and it's also coming out of you. And then also the cyclical. Like that's one of the things I obviously is so obvious here now. I didn't know the cyclical. This when I was working, I didn't even know how something's related. And yet over a two-year time, I came back to spring again in a lot of ways. So there's the winter and the spring and frustration and then relief. But there's never an idea of, for sure, I've made it, security. There's always the ongoing. So, and then the intense listening to yourself and to what's around you and to seeing yourself in the world. Somebody said, creativity is intensely conscious human encountering the world in which he or she lives. And I think that's probably true. And what the artist is trying to do is to become as intensely conscious and then become even more intensely conscious and then even more intensely. So it's an ongoing thing. You don't all of a sudden say, whoops, now I got it. Like I can play basketball. Now I'm an intensely conscious person. Why, you know, it's a continual opening of yourself to what's around and what could come out of you. In a sense, you are a conduit for something more. Another thing that, I have all these little quotes because they've meant a lot to me, and I'm hoping that they will click something in you. But creativity, like holiness, can be resisted like any force. And I think that's what we often do, that we would rather not be involved in creativity, we'd rather not really confront holiness or be involved in holiness because it's not easy to be involved with. It's something that we have to be open to, and it's not like, hey, this is a comfortable warm chair. Yeah?
I feel that creativity, that we can be creative. We don't need to paint pictures. We don't need to write books. But we have our own creativeness within us, and that we need to use it because it's a God-given gift.
Right. That's part of what I'm saying, that each person is a very special person, but each person is also participating in something that's greater than themselves. And part of the way to know your participation is to be involved in the process of creating.
There is a kind of universal, not universal, but sort of a public lie, isn't there, about how holiness and or spiritual, whatever you want to call that, and or creativity is supposed to be lovely and comfortable and something that is just easy. And in fact, it seems to me that it may be closer to pain or itch or something that you feel driven to do. I mean, I do think that people always idealize the especially the visual artist, but into saying, isn't this wonderful fun you're having? It may be fun, but it may be...
Yeah, one of the things that you give people, and especially stuff that I'm doing very simple stuff. I mean, my work is very simple. If someone walks in and says, well, I can pour paint, you know, that's... And I think it's true. A lot of artists who are, well, really super artists, in my eyes, people walk in and say, oh, my kid could do that. And that may be true. That isn't the point. I think part of it is the process of their struggle with themselves and their visual. I happen to be working with semi-gloss house paint because my husband and I used to paint houses, you know, and I don't denigrate it. You know, a lot of people say, well, I have to use this Winsor Newton and so on, and I say, hey, you know, paint is paint. And so I'm coming from who I am. I go to garage sales. I have a lot of junk around, you know, so that is part of why I'm there. But that's just me. That doesn't make it any better than anyone else, like you say. Everyone is participating in that in their own way. And it's getting to accept the fact that change and newness can come rather than fearing it, I think, is one of the main things.
But you have to get over the frustration first.
Well, frustration is part of the process. You can never get over frustration. You can never get over everything we said there. That every single time, like, I can say, well, here I started to play. So I can look at three or four pieces and say, I'm soaring, you know, they relate, they come, they're just there. But then all of a sudden, then where's the next step? So frustration is always there. And to say that we have to get over it, I think is wrong. The fact that we have to live with it and go through it, I would agree with.
Maybe helps us grow.
Yeah, definitely helps us grow. I think frustration is a place that's telling us. You know, when we feel frustration, it's a way of ourselves telling ourselves that there's something more here. I can either do more, I can understand more. And often the thing to do, I have a friend who said, you know, even if you go in your studio and sit there all day and do nothing, you're sitting there. And the importance of sitting still and not busying, you know, finding out what the frustration is about. What are you frustrated with? You know, listening to yourself, listening to what comes out of who you are. Yeah, that's very much it. Mark?
Just for your own connectedness, a lot of this ties in with what we're going to do in the spirituality class tonight.
Oh, really? I thought it might.
The comments about pain.
Yeah. Dave, oh, there.
I think one way of looking at creativity or many things is problem solving. Of having a problem or having a challenge, and what you need to do is come up with a new solution. The creative process is going through and taking a set of constraints or a set of goals or both, and then coming about through trying different solutions. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think it's an easy feeling when you feel troubled or you feel like you don't know what it is, so it's not comfortable. But out of old solutions, of looking for new solutions to solve the problems you're dealing with or the challenge you have, I think you come up with something different, or can come up with something different that you need and works for you or works to solve a certain problem, whether it is in human relations or whether it's in a building or a painting process.
Well,
look, in terms of problem solving in one level, in one sense, is a problem.
Problem solving, yeah, you can look at it that way, but it's also something more. It's letting something come that is not even before you. I mean, it's being involved with something that's more than that. One of the things I want to say in relationship to what you said, but not negating what you said, Mae Sarton and many other people who are involved in creative work talk about when the muse has left. She's got a couple novels and things. The muse is gone. And the worst thing is to not feel anything. Like you're saying, you know, you may feel uncomfortable, you may have to solve a problem, you may... These are all okay because there's a you're relating to it. But when the muse is gone, it's like you're totally empty. And there's nothing prickling you, or there's nothing frustrating you, or there's nothing ready to go. And in this one book called The Poet and the Donkey, this old man who's a poet is just devastated because he woke up in the morning and there was nothing. He had nothing to say. He had, you know, and he said, the muse has left me. And that... You know, as long as you've got something there that's frustrating you, the worst place is the apathy or the nothingness. And it's jerking ourselves out of that to participate in what is around us and participate in our own self, really. That part is, rather than the problem and the dis-ease being the problem, it's the boredom or the apathy or the nothingness that is the problem for a creative person. But you have to go through that. I think this is not like all of a sudden you become creative, you know, and then boom, it's boredom comes, apathy comes, it's in and out over and over again. And once you felt the real high, a creative high where something new that you have participated in has happened, and once you've known that high, it's like you want to have it happen again. But and sometimes I say, no, I don't, because it was too much work. It was too much pain, you know. And then I say, well, maybe it was worth it. Carol?
How do you present your, this was work to be done for seminary about the Holy Spirit?
No, this was for my doctorate.
Doctorate.
I had, in seminary, I did paintings on canvas and drawings.
How do you present that?
Well, I just, at that time I had...
I should say, how in the world did they evaluate it?
Well, I had some neat professors that were. One of them was he's a homiletics professor. At the same time, he was doing a PhD on D.H. Lawrence, so he was involved in creativity anyway. But it had a lot to do with sitting down and talking as a group. So there were peers, there were other seminarians, and four or five faculty, and I presented all my drawings and all my paintings. And what I did is I had a list of titles that I had titled paintings, but I did not put them with the paintings or the drawings. And I asked them to go around and look at all the paintings and connect A to B, you know, connect them. And I was so pleased because they got what David was about 80%. We agreed.
It was even higher than that. It was very amazing.
It was really
amazing. All your works were very abstract.
They were just color. One of them was titled Resurrection. One was Mary also wore orange, and you know I had these strange titles. And then they were just really shapes. A lot of hard edged work prior to this, and then also a lot of felt tip drawings.
When you were doing the paintings you're discussing now, were they entitled after the fact, or when you were painting, did you have a concept in mind? Say how do I respond to the resurrection?
Both. That happens a lot. It's sometimes while I'm Baby on a Toaster got titled while I was working on it. That piece took, I mean, it as far as responding, I mean, that got to be a little heavy for me as I was doing it. Because you had this doll with these eyes and you're pouring paint and the eyes get cut, you know, it's like, oh, what am I doing? But others, I can't title. I don't even, you know, I look at them and they're called like Spirit Study 1, Spirit Study 2, Spirit Study 3. And
I always thought it would be fun to have a typical church sign. I pass by several church signs on the way to my church every morning, and I look at titles, but I thought it'd be wonderful to have a church sign that was changeable. And you just went out and you said, Untitled one, untitled for the sermon title. It drives me crazy that they have all these little catchy things.
That's a good idea, Carol. Okay, so there's six main points. It's time. Intense listening, anticipate, accept change as a challenge for life, or participate in that. Begin again and again and again. There's always new birthing. Know that what you have to express is important somehow. You may not always know, but somehow what you have to express is important. Following one's nerve from within yourself, and that it's cyclical. The idea of creativity is cyclical, that you go through winter to spring again and again and again. And just one last quote here. This is Rollo May from This Courage to Create. I propose that it is the experience of this is the way things are meant to be. If only for that moment, we participate in the myth of creation. Order comes out of disorder, form out of chaos, as it did in the creation of the universe. The sense of joy comes from our participation, no matter how slight, in being as such. This is in the bookstore. The Courage to Create by Rollo May. Yes, you can see how many times I've read it. Each color is a different time I've read this book. But he has really, just even reading one chapter, you know, gets your mind going and thinking about creativity in relationship to yourself. And I think that's what's really important. That's our response to the life we've been given, I think, is allowing ourselves to be creative. Okay, that's all I have to say. If you have any more questions or anything, but time is just gone.
You mentioned that the paint stuck on certain plastics better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Which type of plastic did it stick on better?
Well, I didn't want it to stick on.
Right.
This black kind, it stuck. And I don't know why. It just must have chemically accrued to it. Then I had a beige, very thin garbage bag that was really huge. And it pulled right off. So I don't know if there was a special surface or what. If it was smoother, I don't know. And now when I go back, I'll try different plastics. Like that one at the end was a 3 mil or more, just clear plastic I bought at Kmart or something. And it didn't stick to that either. So it just really depends.
This gives new dimensions of horror to the renter who wants to
yes.
A house to an artist. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And when you talk about believing in yourself, are you well past the point when you don't say you're not believing? What are they
going
to say?
No, I'm not past that at all. I have to, especially since I do sort of weird things, I'm constantly struggling with that, and I have to set it aside because it's just like I have a huge stumbling block that I always, and I'm the one that puts it in front of me, that, you know, what is someone going to say? I'm very much raised with fitting in, not doing anything that was, you know, and so I have to, it's one of my burdens. Constantly. Some artists don't have that. And I really,
is that right?
Yeah, they just go ahead and man their on.
It's just like an innate belief in themselves.
Yeah. See, and that's why a lot of artists are, one, difficult to live with, and two, ego.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really, they're so sold on what they have to say that they are, then sometimes they get involved very much that is the answer, you know, and then they have the only answer. That's why I try to say, you know, participation with something that's greater than yourself, because then you can't get too ego involved. You know, sort of like, oh, look what happened. You know, I co-created this. Yeah. Lake Wobegon.
Did you ever consider giving the paint? You left the canvas. Was there ever a point where you said something could accomplish this better than paint?
Well, I don't know. You know, I've thought of that. A lot of my work now is very sculptural, and I still call myself a painter, so I have some kind of relationship with that. But recently I've been doing drawings, a lot of drawings, and then I'll cut the drawing up and then weave it into itself, so it becomes a new thing. So I don't know. I'm going to come back to that probably, because I think it's that I just like painting.
And so, but at that time you didn't, that was just not something you wanted.
No, I just didn't even think about it. You know. You got any ideas?
Well, it's just like, you know, when I see this from the paint hanging, I think, wow, that's neat. But then I thought, oh, ribbon.
You know, it's funny, because in an art magazine, a couple years after this, there was an artist who made a huge, long line of hanging ribbon from floor to ceiling, bright colored ribbon, you know, in a circular sort of snake form, and that was the show. And part of my problem is I don't have enough money to buy that much ribbon. I could buy a gallon of paint. Yeah, and if I had a lot of money, yeah, another thing I thought of, which I didn't have enough money for, is, you know those feather boas? I would love to have a whole long with just all these different colored feather boas, you know? That would be, but do you know how expensive feather boas are?
They're ostriches.
You know, so yeah, I think of these, but I'm really limited by money.